and mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio, and I also say the views and opinions are those of the speaker and do not represent those of KKCR, its board, its underwriters, its programmers, or anyone else. And our guest today is Dr. Michael Ancharski. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to see you. You haven't been in that seat for a while, and it's always good to have you on the air.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And what's our topic today?
Today we're going to be talking about low thyroid condition, and I think this is a very important topic because it's a prevalent condition, and it's one that often goes undiagnosed for too long, and it's very important to get that situation corrected. So we're going to talk about the issues of low thyroid, and then towards the end, how adrenal glands and hormones play an interaction with thyroid.
And we're not going to take calls until 12:45. We'll let Michael Ancharski chat, and then we'll take calls later on, so please hold back. Thank you. Okay.
All right. Well, low thyroid disease, or hypothyroidism, is a disease where your thyroid gland, which is in the mid-neck, fails to produce an adequate amount of thyroid hormone. And when this happens, it's not just a small issue, because unlike the necessity of particular foods or supplements, you absolutely need a correct amount of thyroid for all of the functions in the body. In fact, thyroid hormone controls the rate at which every single cell takes in oxygen and nutrients and puts out waste products. So every single cell of your body, the rate at which it metabolizes is controlled by thyroid. And some of the symptoms of low thyroid, and even though these are somewhat general, and what happens whenever I list these symptoms is everyone thinks they have low thyroid because these are very common symptoms, but it's the constellation of these symptoms along with certain tests that will determine if we're running low. And the symptoms that indicate a potential low thyroid are a weight gain that's not appropriate for the amount being eaten, so an excessive weight gain in relation to the food being consumed, low energy, and this can be very, very low energy, and inability to produce normal sweat, although that's a little harder to tell here on the island with this climate. But if say you're in a workout class, if you tend to be somebody that sweats a lot less than everyone else or has difficulty working up a sweat, that would be another symptom. Another is low reflexes, which you kind of have to test. The doctor or someone can test your reflexes. They tend to become sluggish. Depression is a very, many of the cases of depression that come into my office turn out to be low thyroid. Poor sleep, dry skin and thinning hair or hair loss. And then a classic one, again, not as prevalent in this climate, is cold hands and feet. So if a patient tells me they always wear socks to bed, or if even when I'm shaking hands with them, they have an ice cold hand, that's one indicator in that direction. Now, it was never taught to me in medical school why exactly, but women tend to have low thyroid almost somewhere between 5 to 1 over men. So 5 times, maybe even greater than that, than men do, even though the thyroid glands of both sexes are exactly the same and theoretically should work the same. So this is why towards the end of the talk here, I'll talk about the relationship of thyroid and estrogen. They kind of have a inverse relationship. When estrogen is too high in the body, it can drive thyroid down a bit. The largest group of people that end up with low thyroid have an autoimmune disease, which means that your body creates antibodies to attack its own tissues. And in this case, it creates antibodies that attack the thyroid gland. And that particular condition is one of the more prevalent causes of low thyroid, and it's called Hashimoto's disease. We're supposed to be moving away from diseases named after people, but this one has retained its name. At any rate, what happens in that particular condition is initially there's a high thyroid condition, which can be very dangerous, but it's usually short term. High thyroid symptoms are the opposite. You lose weight, you can't sleep at night, have a lot of energy, you sweat excessively. If you've ever seen people where you can see the total white conjunctiva of the eye completely surrounding, like where their eyes look like they're bugging out, that is a condition you see in high thyroid. And the heart sometimes starts to race. So high thyroid can be a very life-threatening situation, but it's usually somewhat subtle, and very often people don't go into the doctor when they're having those symptoms because they have all this extra energy and they think that's a good thing. At some point, all that excess production of thyroid starts to burn the thyroid out, and the antibodies keep attacking it to where the condition then goes to low thyroid. And that's where the people end up, a lifelong low thyroid. And there are some pretty good tests, but often the standard doctors, just due to insurance constraints, whatever, don't often do all of the tests that I think are important to do in a thyroid screen. And those tests that I think should be done is, one is a TSH, which is thyroid stimulating hormone. And that is a hormone put out by your pituitary gland up in the brain, which tells the thyroid when to make more or when to quit making thyroid. It's kind of like a thermostat. If it detects a low amount in your blood, the TSH rises to tell your thyroid to make more. If the TSH is low, it's telling your thyroid not to produce thyroid. So the TSH is very important. And I think in addition, free T4, it's not a free test, but it's called free T4. And then there's also free T3. Probably if you're only going to get two tests, TSH and free T4 are the most important. But I like to get the TSH, free T3, and free T4. And then in addition to those three, you can also have a test that looks for those antibodies that attack your own thyroid so that you can see if you're in that category of low thyroid or not. Another thing that's an older, old school naturopathic type test is to take basal body temperatures. And the way you take those is with a special basal body thermometer that's more fine. It's not designed for fevers. It's more finely graded in the metabolic temperature range. And so what you do is, as soon as you wake up in the morning and you know you're not going back to sleep, but even before you go to the bathroom, take your temperature and write it down. And then about 3 hours later, you can take a temperature again. And generally, we see if people are consistent with that first temperature of 97 or less, that's a very high indication that they may need to be on thyroid. So I often will use that test in conjunction with the blood tests. Now, what is the treatment for thyroid? Well, unlike other things, thyroid is pretty much a simple treatment. You have to replace the thyroid that your body isn't making. If the tests come back for me and somebody has some of those symptoms, but they're not severe, and the tests either show a minimally low thyroid or a low normal thyroid, I will sometimes use the two nutritional substances that your body uses to make thyroid hormone. It uses an amino acid from proteins called tyrosine, and it uses iodine. Now, generally, back in the 50s and 40s, it was found that many people from the Midwest, because of farming practices, had very low iodine, and it was called the goiter belt. They actually developed enlarged thyroids. So iodine was added to fortified foods like breads and et cetera. Likewise, iron was also deficient. So we end up with, if you eat much in the way of packaged foods, which you shouldn't do anyway, you end up with quite a bit of iodine and iron. And we now know that even though those two substances are critical to have in proper amounts, that when you have excess, it acts as an oxidation, or it kind of causes your systems in the body to oxidize. So they can be somewhat not helpful, in fact harmful, if you excessively supplement iron or iodine. But we do need iodine when you are low thyroid. So again, on the people that are low level not quite in a serious full-blown hypothyroid, I'll have them start with taking some iodine and some tyrosine. The tyrosine is usually 500 milligrams a day up to 1,000 milligrams a day. And the iodine, usually 150 micrograms, that's micrograms, and up to, say, 450 micrograms a day. And I usually prefer them to get their iodine in kelp or seaweed-type products, although you can also use potassium iodide, which is a common potassium iodide salt. So that's something that can be done if somebody is just low normal or having the symptoms of low thyroid, but their tests come back showing normal but low normal. I'll sometimes do that. And then the big debate beyond that is, what do we give for thyroid? There's two types of main types of prescriptions that can be used. One is a synthetic thyroid, which is not a bad product. Synthetic sounds like it's plastic, something like that. But synthetic thyroid was an improvement over previous thyroid preparations in that it was very consistent. It could be made precise in the laboratory. And it's synthetic T4, so it mimics your own T4 in the body. Now, something it's important to know about these two, T4 and T3, they're the main components of your thyroid hormone. T4 is four times more plentiful in the body, and therefore that's why it is chosen as the main thing to use for prescription replacement therapy. And your body also converts, in a healthy person, in your liver and in your skin and your muscles, you convert some T4 to T3. Now, more recently, we've found that T3 is, while it's only one-fourth as prevalent, is three times more active. So the net effect is that T4 and T3 have almost similar effect in the body. And therefore, I prefer to use the animal thyroid for my prescriptions for people for a couple reasons. One is it very closely approximates what human thyroid does, the same ratio of the T4 and T3. It also seems to have more of a stimulatory effect on your own thyroid to produce some thyroid. Often when you're in low thyroid, you can progress all the way to the point where your thyroid totally shuts down and doesn't produce anything, and then you have to be on what we call total replacement, which is about 2 to 3 grains of thyroid. More often than that, you're in the 1 to 1.5 grain level where your thyroid is underproducing, but it's still producing some. So you just need to augment what your thyroid is doing. And I find the natural thyroid works better for that. So generally, you're put on an amount of thyroid. Usually, immediately, you feel better. In fact, in the old days, some of the doctors I practiced with coming up, they would put many people, which kind of not a great practice, but they would put people that were overweight and very sluggish on thyroid, even without doing a lot of the what is more current testing. And most people, if I rounded up 1,000 people, well, not 1,000, 100 people over here at Foodland in Princeville and put them on a half grain of thyroid, they would all probably say they feel better and are happier. But I think you should only give it to people that need it. But so generally, you give the thyroid. It's usually fairly noticeable pretty quickly that it's working. And then usually you have to wait about 4 to 6 weeks to see if you're at a good level. And you relook at the blood tests and the temperatures, and then you can modify it either upward or downward to get the person pinpointed.
I have a question. Out of those 100 people, how many would have low thyroid? What's the percentage?
You know, I didn't write that down, but I would say it's one of the 10 common conditions that come into the doctor, and especially you should suspect it in females that have this whole list of symptoms going on.
And is this people of a certain age, or?
It tends to hit people. And it can hit at any age, but it tends to hit people in their upper 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then there's another surge in people's older years. One of the things you have to really watch in people that are, say, above 50 is that a small amount of thyroid can have, there's a tipping point where rather than going up by half a grain at a time, you are a quarter or 0.025 milligrams in the synthetic. You have to go up in very small increments with an elderly person because at some point they notice a very small amount. So it is a common illness, and it's one that's now fairly easy to diagnose and fairly easy to treat. But it makes a huge difference because if you're going around with a metabolic rate that is less than optimal, everything you do is going to just be harder than everyone else doing it. It's going to be like you're walking uphill when they're walking level. When you're trying to lose weight, it just won't happen. You just don't have, not only do you not have energy, but you kind of lose a zest for life. So you tend to be in that kind of blah, feeling like every day is a struggle type thing. So it is a very important thing. Now I'm going to just talk a bit, and then we'll open it up to questions. I'm going to talk a bit about the relationship of thyroid to other endocrine or other hormonal glands in the body. And there's a topic which most of my standard medical colleagues don't really use, and they don't understand it the same way that naturopathic doctors do. But I think more and more people are starting to realize its relationship with everything else, and that is adrenal function. And adrenal function, there's absolute diseases when you have either a tumor or non-production of essential hormones in the adrenal gland. But there's also a more subtle situation that when I was trained was called low adrenals or adrenal fatigue, and that's when a person has either been under stress for a long time, a lot of emotional stress, or perhaps immune suppression, a chronic fatigue syndrome, or a chronic virus, hep C, one of these types of chronic viruses, even herpes, that people can get, their systems can be somewhat run down. And one of the functions of the adrenal gland, it does a bunch of things, but one of the functions is it puts out the energy hormones, the adrenaline, norepinephrine. It puts out the things that give you that extra boost of energy or endurance. And it's something that kicks in under times of stress. So it's a protective organ when you need that extra boost. Two things can happen. One is as a part of a general slowing down of the entire system, the adrenals can just be a bit sluggish, so they're not putting out that boost as you need it. And another thing that can happen is that just because of a person's behavior type, like type A personality or somebody that's a little more hyper, is they tend to put out inappropriate surges of these adrenal hormones so that it kind of, it's no longer a fight or flight response or a protective response. It starts to be something that gives them anxiety, or it starts to be something that interferes with normal functioning. So both can be a situation, either underproduction of the adrenal hormones or an excessive chronic overstimulation of the adrenal glands so that they poop out.
I have a question about coughing and adrenal glands.
Yeah, often people that really need their coffee in the morning, and you know, there's people where we now know coffee is a very good antioxidant. It also is something that can provide healthy benefits. But for the person that absolutely needs 2 and 3 cups to get moving in the morning, then we start to look at, is their system such that they're unable to produce energy in a natural way? And then that makes them self-medicate towards a stimulant. And caffeine is a nice, strong stimulant, and especially in some of the coffee drinks prepared today, you can get pretty good shots of caffeine. Say nothing of the popularity of things like Red Bull and whatever that are shots of caffeine. But caffeine can have a lot of effects around the body. In the short term, it can cover for weaknesses that are there. But in the long term, it starts to be something that can be harmful. It's not good for people with heart disease, not good for a number of situations. So at the very minimum, I try to have people either wean down their coffee, go to an organic decaf, maybe go to green tea, which has some other substances that counteract the caffeine in it. And I think there's some other ways to go for coffee. But it is a sign when somebody comes in and they tell me they drink coffee through most of the morning and early afternoon just to get through their day, then I'm thinking low adrenals, perhaps even low thyroid, because it's usually a self-medicating urge to get energy. So there are ways. The adrenal gland is kind of hard to test. You can test the absolute absence or excess of certain hormones that are put out by the adrenal gland, but for the type of thing that I'm talking about, low adrenals or adrenal insufficiency or fatigued adrenals, you can also do 24-hour urine or even some a little less accurate saliva tests that give you an idea of, they look at some of the metabolites of adrenaline and they look at things like cortisol, and those will give you some indication of how the adrenal gland is functioning. But in terms of medicines for the adrenal gland, there's not really... You want to treat, you know, the stress that the person is under. You want to treat other medical conditions going on. Have them normalize weight, which often normalizes. Normalizing weight will often normalize many of the glandular functions around the body. And so the treatments I like best are medicines that are called adaptogens. And adaptogens, mostly herbal, are the ones that I use. And they have long historic use, but they're not well understood by modern medicine, and for a very good reason. They kind of fly in the face of normal pharmaceutical thinking. And an example of that is you can give an adaptogen to somebody with low blood pressure, and it'll raise their blood pressure up. And you give an adaptogen to somebody with high blood pressure, and it'll bring it down to normal or move it down. Likewise, if somebody is low female hormones and you give them adaptogen, their body comes up a little closer to normal. If you give it to somebody who has excess hormone production, it'll bring it down a little bit. So, and the nervous system, an adaptogen can make a stressed out person relax, and it can boost the energy of a really kind of lethargic, no energy person. So a true adaptogen normalizes various balances in the body. And some of the best examples are the medicinal mushrooms that the Chinese first popularized. And the one I use the most is cordyceps, which was not available up until not that long ago. The reason being is that it's a mushroom that grows up in like the Tibetan highlands, the Himalayas, and areas like that, where it's a very hardy mushroom, very sparse. But since that time, back then it could only be used for the emperors or the very wealthy people. But since that time, cordyceps, they found a way to cultivate it, and it's now widely available. But cordyceps is it is an adaptogen in that it boosts the immune system, it boosts the energy in a person. Or you can take mushroom combinations that might include reishi and maitake and shiitake and various other medicinal mushrooms. So there are nice combinations available. Or you can eat the mushrooms or use a high-potency cordyceps product. Another thing that I'll use that's a adaptogen, it's called rhodiola. And rhodiola is a very nice herb. There's, in fact, something I would recommend for most people to read that are approaching the age of 50 or beyond would be Andrew Weil's new book called Healthy Aging, and he has a whole section in there about rhodiola, but it's truly a very unique herb, especially on the nervous system, in that it can really give people energy, and it can also take away some of that nervous energy or anxiety. So it's something that I'm using quite a bit, and its action is apparently on the axis of the adrenal, hypothalamus, and pituitary, which is kind of a a whole neurological input to the hormone systems, and it can impact imbalances favorably. And another one that I use more for elderly people, especially if their energy is low, is Siberian ginseng. And all of these plants have something in common, these adaptogens, the ones I've talked about. They tend, the three, rhodiola, Siberian ginseng, and cordyceps, all come from, they're very hardy plants that withstand a lot of stress in their growing process. And if you think about the way that native peoples thought about medicines, likewise, when we're under a lot of stress, something that has learned to survive a lot of stress seems to help us handle that stress. So I find that somewhat interesting. And let's see. Now, the other thing that can affect, and again, we are going to open this up for questions. Hopefully I'm not chatting too much here, or I'm trying to give a good synopsis of low thyroid. Again, remember we said that thyroid occurs in women at a much, much, much higher rate, many fold over men. And there's an inverse relationship with estrogen. And estrogen, if there's excess estrogen in the body, it tends to suppress thyroid. And if there's not enough estrogen, thyroid can actually elevate a little bit. But we're looking more at the suppression of thyroid with estrogen. And how do you get too much estrogen? Well, it's a condition we call hyperestrogenism, and it's just now starting to be understood in that if a person, the way you clear estrogen, you produce normal estrogen in your cycle, and the way you clear it out of the body is through the liver and bowel, the same way you detox other chemicals. And if the liver's not working well or busy dealing with other issues, even caffeine, it can be a little sluggish at removing estrogen as it cycles through its production and removal from the body. Likewise, if weight is gained, estrogen gets stored in the extra fat that is put on. Another place, if you're not having enough fiber to have regular bowel movements, if there's a constipation situation, estrogen is held in the body longer and it's not removed, so there's a net gain effect of excess estrogen from that. Exercise seems to normalize and improve the estrogen clearance in the body. Another major issue is certain dietary compounds. We know there's a very important amino acid called methionine, which is the body uses to help regulate some of the female hormones, especially estrogen. And methionine is found in garlic and onions, various greens, organ meats. But methionine is very important to have in the diet. At any rate, so we find a person with high estrogen, and I think the reason often people come into my office and they fit all the symptoms of low thyroid, but I have to keep in the back of my head, or is this person a high estrogen person? And maybe because they produce sometimes the similar symptoms. So what I'll usually do, for most doctors, treating high estrogen is difficult because you got to make the person not be constipated. You have to have them lose weight. You have to have them clean up a diet. You have to do a bunch of things to normalize the female hormones. And so what doctors, if you're in a hurry or you want to get a quick solution, you give thyroid, which tends to normalize the balance. But then what you have is higher thyroid and higher estrogen, or you give progesterone to restore the estrogen-progesterone balance. But in those situations of high estrogen, if you give progesterone, then you have a patient that has too much estrogen and too much progesterone. So you're kind of overworking the system. Anyway, we're not going to go heavily into that, but I find it very important to, whenever you're treating, especially a borderline low thyroid, to see if you can bring the female hormones under balance as well before you put them on lifelong thyroid. Some of the things that help lower estrogen in these, and generally the symptoms of high estrogen, other than weight gain and constipation, is that you start to see a discrepancy in the first half of the cycle and the second half of the cycle. Maybe the tip of the iceberg is what we would call PMS or hormonal changes that are more obvious in the week before the period starts. And in those changes might be mood swings, cravings for chocolate and coffee, skin changes, depression, any number of things. So the treatment, and then that, like I say, that's the tip of the iceberg, because high estrogen over time can also contribute to a whole number of more serious GYN conditions like fibrocystic breast disease, endometriosis, uterine fibroids, ovarian cysts, abnormal cycles, abnormal bleeding. So it is something that is not just like PMS is just a small thing. In fact, PMS can be also a very serious condition at some point. So the things from a natural standpoint that I like to use to kind of bring the estrogen into balance is an herb called chaste tree berry or Vitex, and also some extra B6, one of the B vitamins. The omega-6 oils, things such as evening primrose or black currant oil that boost the GLA. And simply enough, it's found that almost all conditions of high estrogen tend to improve with the addition of some calcium and magnesium. And I'll usually go at a 1-to-1 ratio, unless the person is at an age where they need more calcium, like a postmenopausal woman. I'll go to 2-to-1 ratio of calcium over magnesium. And then the herbs that help the liver, like milk thistle, dandelion is really good in these estrogen conditions because it works in the liver, it works in the bowel, it works to help break down estrogen. It also keeps the kidneys functioning well. So it's kind of an all-purpose detox herb, good old dandelion root. And turmeric is right in there, it does some functions in that direction. And then the last thing, there's some research showing that high estrogen tends to ultimately produce a low serotonin situation where depression sets in and insomnia. And so sometimes giving some of the, I think one of the big treatments now for severe PMS is giving an SSRI prescription, but I prefer like the 5-HTP or tryptophan, so those could also be added in. But anyway, back to thyroid, the summary of this whole talk is that if you have the group of symptoms, weight gain, the inappropriate to what else you're doing, low energy, decreased sweat, ability to sweat, decreased reflexes, depression, poor sleep, cold hands and feet, thinning hair or hair falling out, dry skin, dry patchy skin, all of these are signs that you should have your thyroid looked at. And then a test you can do yourself is get a basal body thermometer and keep your temperature each morning and write that down.
And what's a basal body thermometer?
Well, it's one that looks more at the basic metabolic rate of your body. So rather than checking for high fevers, which most thermometers are designed for, it has a narrower range. And so it's much more finely graded, let's say between 96 and 100. So that, because 98.6 is kind of a normal body temperature. It does fluctuate a bit during the day, but when we start to see numbers under 97 or even the low 97s, that's kind of an indication of a low metabolic rate, perhaps a low thyroid. So it's just one augmenting test that we can do along with the very good lab tests that they now have.
So can one buy these thermometers at
the
pharmacy?
Yeah,
you can get them. Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, I don't even know that they're all digital. I'm from the old days when they actually had mercury in thermometers. Probably good that they don't anymore. But the digital thermometers, I think there's still basal body digital thermometers that are more graded in that metabolic range. So yeah, you can just get one of those at Long's or anywhere. Got to ask for a basal body thermometer. They're also used for women that try to do a temperature ovulation chart. They're the similar thermometers used for that. But the key things to take away from this is that it's very important to treat thyroid. And if you've been put on a thyroid prescription, you shouldn't just quit taking it ever. Even if you feel better or whatever, you should have your levels tested and either wean down if you don't need it, or take it if you do need it. But it's not like, you know, ibuprofen or something like this that's an add-on medicine that you can do with or without. It's something that is a part of how your body works, and you really are going to have an unhappy and unhealthy life if your thyroid function is not in normal range. So it isn't like an emotional decision. It should just be a very objective decision in treating thyroid. And there's no, we don't understand exactly what happens to thyroid, but I'm sure it's the whole exposure to toxic metals, environmental pesticides. We do know that low thyroid tends to run in siblings and in families. So if you have a female relative that is also on thyroid, that's probably an indication you should watch a little more carefully for that. So we don't totally understand, other than with that autoimmune disease, we understand you make antibodies and fight your own thyroid. We don't know why you do that. But at any rate, hopefully I've cleared up the overall issue of low thyroid. So I'll go ahead and open it up to calls right now, and we can talk about, hopefully, the things I talked about. But any major question you have is...
Yes, if you want to speak with Michael Ancharski, 826-7771, and toll-free 866-275-1112. And what's your phone number, Dr. Ancharski, in case people want to see you?
Okay, appointments, 652-5217. I'm in... Lahui office Mondays and Tuesdays, or Mondays and Wednesdays, and I'm in Kilauea office on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So 2 days east and 2 days north. And feel free to make an appointment, and we can look at that or any other issues. I pretty much see the full range of health conditions. I'm one of those people, I think it would be hard for me to be a specialist, because if I have to do the same thing over every day, even though you get real good at it, I like the variety of not knowing what's walking in the door, and the whole detective thing of trying to figure it out.
With Sherlock Holmes going on.
Right.
We have a call. Hold on. All right. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Thanks for the help, Dr. Michael. Question I have is regarding the use of DHEA.
All right.
Do you think that this would affect one's different organ systems, like the thyroid, the thymus, etc.?
I think it's a very good question, and I'll give a short little piece on it. DHEA is something that is one of the what we call precursor hormones put out by the adrenal gland. So it is an adrenal hormone. A step before, so adrenal hormones are made out of a skeleton of cholesterol. So cholesterol is not totally bad in the body. It does some important things. But anyway, so a cholesterol molecule, there's things added to it, and it becomes what we call pregnenolone, which is the mother hormone. And it's kind of like the what I call the female. I usually give pregnenolone to females and DHEA to males. And especially I give DHEA to males as they reach their older years. But there is one thing that I would caution you about. The same population that is really benefited by DHEA, you have to really monitor their prostate glands really well, because like any adrenal steroid type hormone, DHEA, in addition to all the good things it can do, it can sometimes produce an imbalance in some of the hormones that can damage the prostate gland. So especially if a person has known prostate disease or an elevated PSA, I won't give them DHEA. But the things DHEA does pretty much is kind of what your adrenal gland does with its other hormones, is that it enables you to have more energy, recover from injury better. I know a lot of the heavy-duty surfers will use DHEA. It gives you injury recovery much quicker.
I'm 68, and I use DHEA the last couple of years. quite a bit, and I feel fantastic. And to mitigate the bad effects of the DHEA, I eat a tremendous amount of organic soaked, of course, so I can get the phytic acid. Pumpkin seeds.
Yeah, that's good to do. Anything, you know, the soft palmetto, pumpkin, nettle root, all those things protect the prostate gland. The DHEA, the dose I usually recommend for people, you can go pretty high and you can go pretty low. We started back when we first knew about DHEA, like in the 5-10 milligram levels, but I usually have people on 25 milligram preparations, and then I'll use it twice a day. But the times you want to use it is usually first thing. If you wake up and you're sluggish and you feel like you really can't get going, then take a DHEA dose in the morning. Sometimes that's enough to get what you need done for the whole day. For people that are very low, especially elderly males, or not elder, I'm same age as you, so we shouldn't call ourselves
Amen.
Elder. We're the elder statesmen and wise people.
I found that some advice indicating that perhaps one should take it every other day, so that's what I do.
Well, I would be consistent, just go down in the dose if you think you're getting too much. But the one thing I wanted to say is you don't want to take it much past that 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's kind of the low adrenal or low cortisol time of day, what we call snicker time, or or some people, in many cultures, that's siesta time. You eat your biggest meal, and then you take a 2-hour nap right around that low adrenal time. Often that's when some people say they need their afternoon cup of coffee or whatever. But the two low adrenal, low cortisol times in the day, you have this diurnal a biorhythm where you go low about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and then you go low again about 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. And that one is implicated very strongly in those people that have insomnia of a nature where they go to sleep easily, but they wake up about 3 in the morning and they just can't turn their brain off and can't go back to sleep. And that's sometimes that's a low blood sugar caused by the adrenal dip. Anyway, so that's another little bit of a syndrome. But, I applaud you. I wouldn't go much higher generally on a daily basis than 50 milligrams.
Well, I know I'm rolling the dice, but I just feel fantastic.
Oh, yeah, it's a really good.
And I, of course, take lots of melatonin because I'm trying to mitigate the effects of the smart meter and the electromagnetic fields that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, melatonin, I think, is increasingly found to be helpful, not well understood really yet, other than it comes from our pineal gland, which we've, in many cultures, is known as the third eye or the consciousness center. Another thing I wanted to say about the DHEA is I tend not to use it as much in women. One, for the simple reason, it often causes androgen surges so that the women will get... they'll break out, have like acne, or grow more hair on their body than usual. And one way I tell people, especially males, one way to find if you're low in DHEA is if you look at the leg hair from the knee down to the ankle,
mm-hmm.
like when you were 19, 21, 28 or whatever and had that big testosterone amount, you would always, if you have leg hair, it would be full down the whole leg. And as you age and your DHEA goes down a bit, you'll start to see that maybe mid-calf or midway down the leg, there's no more hair. And that sometimes you add DHEA and you see a change in that. You can also test DHEA. The test is called DHEA sulfate in the blood and see where you're at. When I test people that aren't feeling that great, they tend to be either... Most of them tend to be low normal, but the normal range is huge. It goes from like 60 to 900 or something like that. So I'll try to push people up towards the 500-600, even if they're in the normal range. So that's a way you can monitor. And then I have found people that have taken too much of it, and I find that they're way off the charts, and I try to get them back down a little bit. There are some other herbs you can use in conjunction with DHEA, so you have to use less and you still get the same effect, and that would be the adaptogens like take less DHEA and add some rhodiola, some Siberian ginseng, or some cordyceps in there. And you notice that, in fact, one thing they found about cordyceps was that back in the day, about two Olympics ago, whenever the Chinese held the Olympics, the Chinese women were breaking like track and field and swimming records, not by increments like you'd normally see in international competition, not by small increments. They were like blowing these records out of the water, like by huge amounts. And the suspicion was that, of course, the commies were feeding steroids to their athletes, but they found a way to avoid the Olympic testing. So, but the truth of the matter is they were actually clean and they were using cordyceps mushroom, which gives you that endurance and gives you that extra push. So that's a kind of an interesting side story.
Well, in the morning, I take the red Siberian Panax ginseng extractum and a little bit of Panax ginseng. Then in the afternoon, I take the American ginseng for the anti-inflammatory or the yin aspect.
Yeah, I imagine you're a man with lots of energy.
I feel better than I did when I was 18.
Well, good, and thank you so much.
Well, thank
for your
you,
call.
Mike. Dr. Michael, I appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
All right. We have about 7 minutes left, so if you have a question, our topic today is low thyroid, 826-7771, or toll-free 866-275-1112 to chat with Dr. Michael Encharski. And again, his phone number is 652-5217. He's been practicing naturopathic medicine since 1979.
Yeah, I'm starting to get up there.
When you had to use a slide rule.
I still don't know how to do it. One of the things I was going to mention for anybody that's out there that is taking thyroid hormone, it is good to, especially if symptoms change, it is good to have your levels tested every now and again, at least every few years. Often if you're on one dose, it works for quite a while, but then your thyroid can kind of poop out a little more, and you need to take a larger amount. Or in some people, they take thyroid, they get healthier in other ways, they start exercising, they normalize weight, they start taking good supplementation, they're happier. We find that perhaps their need for the amount of thyroid they need might be less. Generally, once you need thyroid, you always need thyroid. That's kind of a general rule, but not an absolute. And it goes to show you the way we related these different conditions, the adrenal and the thyroid and the female hormones, that a lot of things, a lot of medicine on the level of prevention is not really total rocket science. If you normalize weight and you exercise every day and you eat better and you try to do something that makes you happy, you're going to be way ahead in terms of preventing and treating any condition that you'll have. And then any of the medicines can just be icing on the cake to keep it in balance.
The question was, how do you prevent yourself from waking up at 3 in the morning? You mentioned going good night's sleep and then waking up and not being able to go back to sleep.
A couple things. The question was, how do you prevent that waking up and staying awake? Sometimes that's like an anxiety time. And for a person who has anxiety or long-term insomnia, sometimes it can be a little more difficult to fix that. But there are some medicines that produce a deeper sleep so that you don't wake up as easily, like things such as the amino acid L-tryptophan. There's also some new research that you can somewhat control the cortisol levels with things like phosphatidylserine, which is called PS, phosphatidylserine, and it's sometimes combined with things like magnolia or schizandra, some of the Ayurvedic herbs. But generally, I try to get the person in a deeper sleep. And then often it's also a time of low blood sugar. So if sometimes, right, normally we don't like people to eat much before they go to bed. But if you have that problem, you might eat a granola bar or a little rice cake or something that'll keep your blood sugar more even during the night. A classic old-time treatment for people with all kinds of insomnia, I learned this from an old European naturopath, He used to have his elderly patients that weren't sleeping well, he would have them make a strong cup or more of chamomile tea, make it very, very strong, and then he would add organic, you know, stone-cut oats to that oatmeal, basically, but make it in a very, like, cook it long enough so that rather than an actual, it's semi-liquid, so more like of a slurry or a slush of oatmeal, and then add, like, goat milk to it. And, you know, that's not the greatest picture for somebody who's gluten and dairy sensitive, but for people that aren't, that combination often will be something that triggers just a very deep, nice night's rest for our elderly patients. But I'd look at the things about managing cortisol and blood sugar in the night, and then giving some stronger substances, valerian I sometimes use, passion flower, hops. But the one that I come back to most often, the most studied, is the tryptophan. And I find even I can, often I'm asked to take people off of their sleep medications like Ambien, et cetera. And I think that's a good thing to do, and there are some more natural replacements that work. It's not an easy condition to fix, but again, the basics, exercise, good diet, all of those things have some implication for that time of day. Or a person can eat like half a granola bar when they go to bed and keep the other half by the bed, and when they, as soon as they wake up, eat that other half a granola bar, and sometimes that's enough just to get you back to sleep.
Does green tea have tryptophan in it?
Green tea doesn't have tryptophan.
Oh, I thought it did. I thought it has some calming factor.
It has theonine.
That's what it has in it.
Theonine in it, which is counteracts the caffeine a bit. Mm. Theonine, in tests they found it makes for more alpha waves, which is kind of the meditative state or the relaxed state. So it's used more in anxiety treatment than sleep treatment.
Okay. For our last question, this woman called and said she helped her partner with hypothyroid through diet, and she wanted your opinion on that and what we can do.
Yeah, I think if you're low level, not an absolute missing, thyroid hormone, but you're more borderline low, or you've just been diagnosed as very low, I think changing to a more vegetarian diet is very, very helpful, although you do need tyrosine, which is found in protein. So you have to, even if you go vegetarian, you have to go good adequate protein as well. I think that's probably a good thing to do. Losing weight always seems to help thyroid treatment. But, and then there's some specific vegetables that seem to help thyroid, some of the seaweeds. There's a few other herbs that are very good for stimulating the thyroid.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ancharski, for joining us today.
Well,
again, 652-5217 is Michael Ancharski's number. This was very informative, and look forward to having you back again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Aloha.
Yeah.
And have a great day out there.
Right on. And up next, One World Radio with my good friend Richard, or I call him Ricky. There he is. All right. Go well, everyone.